Well, thank you very much. I've handed out a copy of my paper, and you'll see from the title that I've narrowed down the scope of what I am attempting to cover a little bit. Seeing how we've struggled for time, that's probably a good idea. So the title of the paper is The Concepts of Righteousness in 1 Enoch 1 to 36 and Romans chapters 1 to 3, A Comparative Analysis. So that's how I've narrowed things down a little. The ongoing and current debate within Protestantism over the issue of justification should be of keen interest to Seventh-day Adventists, given our historic focus on righteousness by faith. Indeed, the current polemic touches on issues that have been matters of some contention within Adventism for quite a number of decades. However, Adventists largely appear to have been watching from the sidelines. The current debate is spearheaded by N.T. Wright, who argues that the verb dikaio, to justify, does not denote an action which transforms someone so much as a declaration which grants them a status. It is the status of the person which is transformed by the action of justification, not the character. In fact, he argues that Paul used the verb dikaio precisely and exactly in this sense, unlike those who since Augustine have tried to use it to refer to the whole range of becoming a Christian from first to last. Wright argues that God's righteousness in Second Temple Judaism and in Paul's writings means faithfulness to the covenant. Wright holds to Sanders' concept of covenantal nomism. In other words, that Judaism was not a religion of legalistic works righteousness, such as generations of scholars and preachers have imagined. Getting into the covenant is by God's mercy, and staying in is by obedience. In terms of the role of the law, the idea is that now that you're in the covenant, here is the law to keep. So Wright maintains that the key question facing Judaism as a whole was not about individual salvation, but about God's purposes for Israel and the world. Within this scheme, he argues that righteousness in Romans 1:17 refers to God's own righteousness. Furthermore, within the argument of Romans, Wright maintains that it makes no sense whatsoever to say that the judge imputes, imparts, bequeaths, conveys, or otherwise transfers his righteousness. Wright essentially argues that God does not impute moral righteousness from somewhere else. Therefore, justification is not about how someone becomes a Christian, it is the declaration that they have become a Christian. This has proven to be a confronting challenge to traditional Protestant understandings of righteousness and justification. At the forefront of recent responses to Wright has been John Piper, who mounts a strong defence of the traditional Protestant position. Wright, in turn, has responded that Piper fails to grapple with the larger context of Romans chapters 3 and 4. And a very recent and hefty entrant, I must say, in terms of the book that he wrote into the broader debate, has been Douglas Campbell with his monograph, The Deliverance of God, an Apocalyptic Rereading of Justification in Paul. In this work, Campbell argues passionately against the traditional Protestant understanding of righteousness by faith, which he calls justification theory, maintaining that it is not at the heart of Paul's theology, but that the heart of Paul's theology is rather what he calls the apocalyptic inbreaking of the Christ event and the subsequent union of believers with Christ in his death and resurrection. In thus critiquing the traditional Protestant understanding of justification, Campbell aligns himself significantly with Wright. However, Campbell defines salvation as the saving transformation through participation in Christ in the Spirit. And he analogously states that Christians are saved through their participation in the cross. So you see that the traditional Protestant understanding of righteousness is therefore under attack from different quarters. Ultimately, the issues of this debate turn on the broader and fundamental views of the new perspective, as originally proposed by Sanders, regarding covenantal nomism. Some form of covenantal nomism is seen by many scholars today as the underlying framework within which Second Temple Judaism should be understood. However, the basis on which Sanders' work has been critiqued is summarised by Wright himself, when Wright states that Sanders has offered a massive, but to many deeply unconvincing reading of the pattern of religion in Second Temple Judaism. Unconvincing because it is too uniform, unconvincing also because it is insufficiently theological. The most thorough evaluation of covenantal gnomism in recent years has been the two multi-authorial volumes edited by Don Carson. And my reading of the papers in this volume is that in essence they argue that what is needed is a careful and nuanced reading of the text dealing with Second Temple Judaism. In his introduction there, Carson observes that the literature of Second Temple Judaism reflects patterns of belief and religion too diverse to subsume under one label. The results are messy, but if they are allowed to stand, they may in turn prepare us for a more flexible approach to Paul. It is not that the new perspective has not taught us anything helpful or enduring. Rather, the straitjacket imposed on the Apostle Paul by appealing to a highly unified vision of what the first century pattern of religion was really like will begin to find itself unbuckled. This paper analyses the concept of righteousness found in the Book of Watchers, a core Jewish apocalyptic text that was popular in the first century, with that found in Romans chapters 1 to 3, a core section of the Pauline writings. Based on this analysis, some tentative implications will be suggested for the idea of righteousness in the Pauline text and in contemporary first century Jewish texts. And obviously, we can't hope to engage with the full spectrum and depth of the current debate. I haven't mentioned many of those perspectives. However, it's intended that the findings may at least be suggestive and illustrative of the issues involved. What we know of the Book of 1st Enoch is that it's not a single unitary work, but it's rather a major collection of apocalyptic writings. Importantly, the discovery of significant parts of this corpus among the Qumran texts has added determinative weight to the arguments for the early dating for the antiquity of this work. There are a number of important and indeed fascinating reasons why 1st Enoch, of which the Book of Watchers forms a part, may be profitably compared with the Pauline text in terms of its understanding of righteousness. The first reason is the availability of several Enochic texts, and certainly 1st Enoch, which we know was contemporary with the ministry of Jesus, Paul, and the development of the early church. The second reason for the relevance of 1st Enoch in this context was its influence generally on the thought world of the New Testament, and specifically on several New Testament writers. Isaac notes that not only that 1st Enoch was well known to many Jews, but that Enochic concepts are found in various New Testament books, including the Gospels and Revelation. More broadly, the Enochic literature appears to have been highly influential in early Judaism. An important question that must be borne in mind is precisely how sectarian 1st Enoch was. Certainly, at Qumran, it would appear that 1st Enoch enjoyed a status no less hallowed and authoritative than that of the Bible in the circles to which the authors belonged. They were clearly held to be divinely inspired or revealed by angels. Furthermore, while the Qumran community was indeed a sectarian community, to what extent were its views strictly sectarian or typical of Judaism more broadly? In this vein, there can be hardly any doubt of the immense popularity of Jewish apocalyptic within Judaism in the Second Temple period. There is strong evidence to suggest that extant Jewish apocalyptic texts are merely a fraction of what must have existed. Although there appear to have been many sectarian groups within Second Temple Judaism, Russell notes that the composition of apocalyptic literature was not confined to any of these. Furthermore, and regardless of the distribution of the texts, the ideas of Jewish apocalyptic exercised a wide influence upon Second Temple Judaism. Within early Christianity, we know that 1st Enoch enjoyed a privileged position of authority. It was certainly influential and indeed accepted as inspired and canonical in many Jewish and Christian circles in the early centuries of Christianity. Van der Kam observes that the writings of seven authors from the first three centuries of Christian history show familiarity with the Enochic books and accord them authoritative standing. All of them use words like scripture or prophecy in connection with them. Isaac considers that as a work of early Judaism, 1st Enoch helps us to discern the complexities of both intertestamental Jewish thought and early Christian theology. In a historical sense, it overlaps Jewish thought and early Christian, it overlaps the Old and the New Testaments, since it depends on the Old Testament as much as it is influential upon the New Testament and later extra-canonical literature. Barker tantalizingly observes that our failure to find a real place for the Enochic tradition in our picture of Christian origins is a good example of blinkered scholarship. The Old Testament is not the only ancient authority that New Testament writers recognize or cite, despite what we have been told. The important background issue for this paper is not whether Paul quotes or alludes to 1 Enoch at all, but rather, as has been long recognised, that Paul in fact displays a key affinity with Jewish apocalyptic at many levels of his writings. Jewish apocalyptic was a key element in Paul's mental milieu, and aspects of Jewish apocalyptic thought are unambiguously reflected in his work. Paul is not writing an apocalypse. Nevertheless, contemporary scholarship recognises that Paul stands firmly within the Jewish apocalyptic mystical tradition. His understanding of the end of time and the resurrection is firmly apocalyptic. He describes his own spiritual experiences in terms appropriate to a Jewish apocalyptic mystagogue of the first century. Paul was therefore writing within apocalyptic Jewish milieu, and within this milieu, 1 Enoch appears to have been a particularly authoritative text, and as such a comparison between the concepts of righteousness in 1 Enoch and the Pauline text would appear to be a potentially fruitful endeavour. Rutzel notes that dikaiosen is a fundamental term for Jewish apocalyptic. However, we must proceed with care. Even if we grant influence and importance to Jewish apocalyptic literature, Collins does note that the early Enochic literature cannot be regarded as normative for all apocalypses. However, one concept that is common to all types of Jewish apocalyptic is that of dualism. Importantly, this dualism manifests itself eschatologically and ethically, drawing a line between Jew and Gentile, circumcised and uncircumcised. And closely related to this, of course, is the ethical dualism, which posits a distinction between two classes of human beings, such as the righteous versus the wicked, the godly versus the impious, or the holy versus the impure. In regard to this, Gammy tellingly notes that the extent to which ethical dualism predominates in Jewish apocalyptic and sapiential thought has been overlooked in recent scholarship. Gammy observes that whereas the older traditions tend to see a contrast between two opposing groups without or within Israel, some of the later traditions are inclined to identify the sons of Israel with the righteous and the non-Israelites with the ungodly. This latter group of traditions found in the apocalyptic and sapiential literature would appear to be the ones which were more prominent and contemporaneous with Paul's epistles. It is therefore appropriate that, at least to some extent, the analysis undertaken for this paper presuppose a dualistic paradigm. Now, of course, Sanders is aware of 1 Enoch. Sanders, in fact, classes 1 Enoch in particular as being a document, in his terms, which is defective in terms of the pattern that he seeks to demonstrate in the Jewish texts. However, 1 Enoch can hardly be classed as defective in terms of representing at least an influential stream of popular Jewish thought in the first century. Since one of Sanders' great contributions has been, as Westerholm emphasises, to remind us of the need to portray the Judaism of Paul's day in its own terms and from sources other than Paul's writings, it's therefore relevant indeed to have another look at the Book of Watchers. In Borkum's review of the Jewish apocalyptic literature in terms of covenantal gnomism, he notes that Sanders' work depends on an earlier stage of scholarly study of 1 Enoch, unaffected by the Qumran evidence. However, he concludes that this is not decisive for Sanders' assessment of the ideological stance of the major Enochic writings. This may be true for Sanders' assessment of the ideology of the texts. However, the Qumran material is significant in terms of allowing a re-evaluation not only of the dating but also of the influence of the Enochic material in Second Temple Judaism. Having reviewed the apocalyptic texts overall, Borkum concludes that broadly our findings coincide with Sanders. However, there are some differences. The texts tend to presuppose a rather narrower definition of the righteous or the true Israel compared with the broader definition that Sanders finds in the rabbinic texts. More generally, Borkum comments that this is not quite clear, that it is not quite clear that Sanders does justice to these texts by claiming that they exhibit much the same pattern of religion as he finds in the rabbis. In the analysis below, I will necessarily have to look at the words and themes in the selected text. I can't do anything other than that. However, I note that Wright has preempted me by stating that verbal statistics and accidental occurrences of themes are a dangerous guide in incidental writings like Paul's. I guess the point made by Wright must be appreciated. However, it must also be balanced against one of his more frequent assertions, which is that the text is the text. Accordingly, we must venture into the text itself while bearing in mind the broader contextual issues. For the purpose of this analysis, every occurrence of words belonging to the righteousness word group was considered in the Book of Watchers and in Romans 1 to 3. Each reference was classified on the basis of whether it appeared to refer to either end of the polarity explicit in the analytical criteria. The criteria selected for analysis were four polarities, if you like. First of all, is righteousness referring to God's righteousness or human righteousness? Two, is righteousness presented as moral standing or as God's saving activity? Three, is righteousness presented as covenant faithfulness? And four, is righteousness associated with God's grace, mercy and forgiveness? So using those four polarities, I undertake an analysis of the Book of Watchers in comparison with Romans chapters 1 to 3. In the paragraphs that follow there, I have some, that's the fine print. That's where I say all the places where I could go wrong, just so that I demonstrate that I'm aware of that. I just won't cover those for time's sake, but they may be covered in the questions perhaps. Then there is a section here which covers the analysis of the text. It just gives us some numeric statistics. If you go now to, if you have a look at page, I believe it will be page 14 on your copy, I have there tabulated over quite a number of pages. I have actually quoted the relevant passages from the two texts which I am comparatively analysing. And you'll see four columns, which are those four polarities, and I comment as to where I believe they primarily sit. So I won't go through all that at present, but it's on this that this that's the essential analysis, and the conclusions are based on that. I'd like to now go to the findings, which are on page 8. So I've saved us all the hard work at this meeting. I've done the analysis, I guess. I'm going straight to the findings. On criterion 1, God's righteousness or human righteousness. Well, the focus in the Book of Watchers is to a highly significant extent on righteousness as an attribute of humans. Romans chapters 1 to 3, however, presents righteousness as something that pertains to both God and man. Criterion 2, righteousness as moral standing or as God's saving activity. Well, the Book of Watchers almost exclusively refers to righteousness in terms of moral standing. Righteousness is essentially presented as a static quality and is most commonly used as an adjective, like the righteous elect, for example. That's a common phrase. There is no question of becoming righteous. You either are or you're not. There's no question of transferal of righteousness in any way. Borkum notes that the language of election is closely associated with the language of righteousness in this work, and that it is simply assumed that the elect are those who are loyal and obedient to God. And this is generally true of the rest of the Enochic literature as well. However, Romans chapters 1 to 3 predominantly refers to righteousness as moral standing, although there are a significant number of references where it's clear that it is referring to righteousness in terms of God's saving activity. The prominent adjectival use of righteousness as a simple descriptor for a group in the Book of Watchers is almost completely absent from Romans chapters 1 to 3. Criterion 3, is the term righteousness referring to covenant faithfulness? Well, the concept of righteousness is not presented in the Book of Watchers in connection with God's covenant faithfulness. And in the footnotes there is an example of someone who has tried to make that case. I simply cannot see it in any way. There are, in fact, no explicit references to the covenant at all in the text, and I can't find the allusions. In Romans chapters 1 to 3, however, of course, there are several references to righteousness where they're clearly made in connection with God's covenant faithfulness. Criterion 4. Is righteousness associated with God's grace, mercy and forgiveness? And this goes to the heart of, you know, legalism, I guess. Well, in the Book of Watchers, righteousness is, with only one exception, not associated with grace, mercy or the forgiveness of God. In this regard, Borkum comments that in chapters 1 to 5, there is no exhortation to the wicked to repent or for the righteous to even continue in obedience. There is simply a pronouncement of judgment on the apostates and mercy and peace for the righteous. Presumably, there is no possibility of forgiveness for the wicked. By contrast, in Romans 1 to 3, a significant number of references to righteousness are explicitly associated with the grace, mercy or forgiveness of God. So now we come to the conclusions. In terms of the new perspective generally, and bearing in mind of the limitations of this quite brief exercise, it would appear that the Book of Watchers does not explicitly display the characteristics of Second Temple Judaism that the proponents of the new perspective prefer to emphasize. Given the dating and the influence of 1 Enoch, this should at least give us cause to consider again the breadth of the diversity of first century Judaism. As far as the recent debate on righteousness is concerned, this analysis suggests that Paul's usage of words from the righteousness group in Romans chapters 1 to 3 is different to that in the Book of Watchers, and perhaps even significantly so. The Book of Watchers presents righteousness as primarily a descriptively human attribute, while Romans 1 to 3 has much more emphasis on righteousness as the quality that pertains to God and to man. The concept of righteousness as moral standing is apparent in both texts, although in Romans 1 to 3 the idea of righteousness as God-saving activity comes more to the fore. The idea of righteousness as covenant faithfulness is not overtly present in the Book of Watchers. It comes much more to the fore in Romans chapters 1 to 3. And finally, the association of righteousness with grace, mercy and forgiveness is apparently absent in the Book of Watchers, although it is clearly present in Romans chapters 1 to 3. This analysis strongly suggests that in Romans 1 to 3, Paul's use of the concept of righteousness is considerably more organic, multifaceted and generally more complex than the contemporary use of the term in the Book of Watchers. While, on the one hand, we are bound to read the New Testament in its own first century context, it is also true that, on the other hand, the evidence in Paul should be assessed on the basis of his own usage. It is in the balancing of these two requirements that the crux of these issues lies. While Paul uses first century words and concepts, he is at the same time using them to create something that is essentially new. Furthermore, just as it would be wrong to assume the existence of a monolithic Judaism in the first century, it may similarly be equally erroneous to try to circumscribe Paul's use of particular concepts to a single dimension or focus, whether this be philosophically or confessionally determined. What this comparison between the Book of Watchers and Romans 1 to 3 suggests is that there were streams of thought within Second Temple Judaism, and influential streams at that, which can be conceived of as having understood righteousness with a very different focus to what it appears to be Paul's focus. These streams of thought do not necessarily reflect the views of the new perspective well. However, these streams of thought were only that, some streams among many. Second Temple Judaism appears to have been far more complex than many have previously considered. If that is the case, then perhaps we can acknowledge the existence and indeed the value of the emphasis that N.T. Wright offers, while at the same time also appreciating that the value of some of the traditional Protestant perspectives on righteousness and justification. In the final analysis, this study also fundamentally suggests that even when all the contextual considerations have been taken into account, to understand righteousness in Paul, we must start with Paul. And again, to adapt the phrase from N.T. Wright, the Word is the Word.